We will now move on to the next business of the day, and that is Cockrell versus Corteva, number 252204 and 252312.
Good morning. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes rebuttal time.
Granted.
May it please the court, my name is Todd Wozniak. I'm with Holland & Knight, and I represent the defendant's appellants in this matter. With me at the table are Kayla Pradgett, also with Holland & Knight, and Nipun Patel with the Paulson Kelly Law Firm. The panel asked us to focus on two things as primary issues for today. The first is the plaintiff's failure to establish Article III standing for their count four breach of fiduciary duty claim. And the second is the district court's failure to correctly apply a deferential review standard to the plan administrator's construction of the optional retirement provisions of the plan. Now, at trial, the plaintiffs were required to prove Article III standing for each of their claims and each of their remedies. And they were required to do that for each plaintiff and each class member. And they failed to do that with count four, the breach of fiduciary duty count. Plaintiffs concede that their injury for the breach of fiduciary duty claim is not the denial of benefits or any other type of financial or tangible harm. They claim that their harm was being prevented from knowing where they stood with respect to their pension benefits. Now, that injury does not satisfy Article III under either a traditional standing analysis or under an informational injury standing analysis. And I'm going to start with the informational injury standing analysis because the plaintiffs do in their brief. And just remind the court that this is supposed to be a limited exception to the normal standing doctrine. The doctrine applies when a defendant fails to provide information mandated by statute and the denial causes adverse consequences related to the purpose of the statute. And the plaintiffs have not carried that burden here. They, first of all, have not claimed any failure to comply with a statutory disclosure obligation. And I just want to remind the court, ERISA is a very comprehensive regulatory scheme. It has statutory disclosure requirements in the statute. And those include having a written plan document, providing summary plan descriptions, annual reports. There is no claim that the defendant failed to do any of that.
But you don't dispute that there's a fiduciary duty on the part of your client to provide relevant information to beneficiaries.
We are not disputing that.
And that's the nature of the claim at issue here.
That is the claim at issue here, but it is not a statutory disclosure claim. So right off the bat, they're outside the scope of the traditional, they're outside the scope of the informational injury standing. The real claim here is that there's a duty to candor and that they received communications that they feel are misleading or vague or not sufficient in order to educate them on where they stood with respect to the plan. Those types of allegations were dealt with in the court's opinion in Huber. And in Huber, the court said, look, if you got the statutory disclosure, but you also received misleading information, that's outside the informational injury standing. You've got to go to the traditional standing. So the informational standing doctrine is really not available to them here. So let's go to the traditional standing analysis. And that requires them to prove an injury, a concrete injury that was caused by defendants and that can be redressed by the remedy they sought. And they really didn't prove any of that other than perhaps the causation prong for their alleged misleading information.
With both of those, both traditional and informational injury, had the appellees made the argument that they wouldn't have spent their funds, their savings, the way they did, that they would have allocated their own finances differently. Would you agree that that would be sufficient as a concrete injury?
No. First of all, there wasn't a testimony. That's pure argument. It was not testimony that was provided during trial. The testimony provided during trial was there were really two injuries that they referred to. One is that they would have applied for a job at Corteva, which the district court found was not possible because there had been a prohibition on intracompany transfers months before the actual spinoff occurred. So the court's findings foreclosed that alleged injury. And the second one that they mentioned was Mr. Cockrell said, and it was only Mr. Cockrell said, he might try to go on to some sort of pressure campaign with senior management. He didn't identify who he's talking about. He didn't identify what he would say. He didn't identify what he asked for. We don't even know what he's talking about in terms of do something different, I think was the language he used.
But let me return to my question. Had that sort of testimony been in the record, would you agree that that would be sufficient for a concrete injury?
The cases that find concrete injury usually are talking about something more either financial related or tangible. And so, as an example, in Huber itself, the lead plaintiff there said, because of the misleading information, I had to hire somebody to help me understand what my rights and responsibilities were, and that cost me money. That, I think, is a concrete injury. Saying I might have done something different with planning or the way I might have spent money in the future is really kind of speculative. This idea of if I knew, I might have done something different, but I don't know what it would be. It's not a concrete injury. It's far too speculative to meet the test.
But it seems that, at least in theory, there could be something more specific. Like I would have taken, $100 a month from under my mattress and put it in a high interest savings account. And that would have, accrued money over time. Something like that. Would that be sufficient?
I certainly agree that the more specific the testimony gets in terms of this is what I would have done. I would have cut my spending. I would have gone and hired a financial planner, and that would have cost me money. The more specific and the more concrete and tangible you get with what it is that you would have done instead, I don't disagree. That might be sufficient, but none of that was offered here. There was none of that testimony here.
So when Mr. Benson said, more likely than not, I would have found other employment to keep accruing more benefits, is your understanding of that testimony that he's talking about within this sort of Corteva family of companies?
Yes.
Or outside?
The only way he could have accrued additional benefits under the plan would be to be employed by Corteva, one of its subsidiaries. He could not have gone to a third party like Home Depot and said, I'm here, now I get better benefits under the the Corteva now plan.
He didn't say under the plan, though. He just said more benefits.
Okay. Yeah, but he doesn't identify a position. He doesn't identify where he would go. He doesn't identify what benefits he's talking about. There's nothing there. It's pure speculation on his part. I think the only way he could have done that and earned more benefits under the plan, at least, would be to go to Corteva. Okay.
Could you, just as a factual matter, are the members of the early retirement class also members of the optional retirement class?
No, the way the class was defined is the early retirement class are all under the age of 50. So it's 49 and under, and they would have been not eligible for early retirement. What they're arguing is, had I stayed employed with Corteva or Historical DuPont, which was a subsidiary of Corteva, then I could have continued to age into the early retirement. And because I wasn't still employed by Corteva or Historical DuPont, I could not continue to age into early retirement.
But under the way the district court construed involuntary termination, it seems that everyone in both classes would have been involuntarily terminated. I understand you have disputes about that construal with regard to the optional retirement class, but wouldn't that technically apply to the early retirement class as well? In that they were not continuing to work for Historical DuPont.
They were not continuing to work for Historical DuPont. That is correct. All of the employees involved in both classes were transferred to Specialty Products, and Specialty Products ceased participating in the plan as of the date of the spinoff and was spun off with New DuPont as a subsidiary of New DuPont. So all those employees were no longer working for an employer who was a participating employer in the plan.
But I guess these 580 some odd folks who were defined as being members of the early retirement class, that's a separate pool of people from the optional retirement class.
Yes, the optional retirement class was everybody over the age of 50. So they would be early retirement eligible, and some of them did elect early retirement. But they are seeking what we described as kind of a slightly enhanced benefit, which is kind of a severance type enhancement, is what that was intended for. And that's that group.
I'm sorry, you said that some of them elected early retirement in lieu of the optional?
Yes, all of the members of the optional retirement class were over 50 and had more than 15 years of service at the date of the spinoff. So they had already been eligible for early retirement as of the date of the spinoff. So after the spinoff, they could still elect to commence that benefit if they so chose. And so some of them did.
So let's go back to traditional injury. What about breach of trust as a traditional injury?
Breach of trust really requires some sort of mismanagement by the trustee, either self-dealing or insider trading, or just poor management of the assets, and requires a financial harm. So that's not the kind of injuries they're alleging here. They're alleging really this kind of really soft disclosure type claim is what they're really making. That's not breach of trust. They also try to analogize to fraudulent misrepresentation. And again, that's not the kind of harm they're claiming. In fact, they didn't even try to prove detrimental reliance, which is one of the elements of fraudulent misrepresentation. So they really don't line themselves up with a traditional common law cause of action that would allow a typical plaintiff to get into court. It has to be something more than the deprivation of information. There has to be something that deprivation of information leads to some sort of, there's causes some sort of harm. And that's not what was presented here. What was presented here was, I didn't get the information. And they don't even really say if they'd gotten the information, how would that have done anything for them? Because the information they're seeking is a disclosure that you are not entitled to these benefits and you never will be. That doesn't change the non-entitlement of the benefits. It just means you didn't get that information or that disclosure, but there's no harm that flows from it. At least certainly no harm they've identified. And so under the traditional standing analysis too, really have not identified a concrete injury that gives rise to standing.
What is the status of payments, the retroactive payments at this point?
It's my understanding that everybody has made an election, and most, if not all, have received any retroactive lump sum payments. So that has already been largely completed. There may still be some payments that have to be made.
Were we to conclude that there was not standing for the breach of fiduciary duty claim, what is the consequence for those payments that have been made at this point retroactively?
Technically, there are payments that were overpaid and they should not have been paid. So I would assume that the plan administrator is going to ask people to return that money. I don't know that for a fact, but that would be my assumption.
Okay.
If it's all right, I'm going to turn real quick to the plan interpretation issue.
Judge Roth, did you have any questions on standing?
No, I don't. Thank you.
Okay. So with optional retirement, there were really two conditions that had to be met. In the first was there had to be an involuntary termination of employment. And this is right out of the plan document, right? The plan document, this is in the appendix at page 1117. And this is Title I, Section 4D1A. And this is the lead-in paragraph to optional retirement. It says an employee will be eligible for optional retirement after reaching age 50 with at least 15 years of service if his employment would otherwise be involuntarily terminated. And then it goes on with some exceptions. Again, it says employment would otherwise be terminated. It doesn't say you're... employer stops participating in the plan. It doesn't say you were transferred to some other entity. It says your employment would otherwise be terminated. And the plan administrator reasonably construed that to say, yeah, you've got to have an employment loss. You've got to have an employment termination. Now, Judge Bailson said in reaching his conclusion that that was a incorrect interpretation. First of all, he said this is unambiguous. And he said, defendants cannot point to anything specific in the administrative record, whether plan language or otherwise, indicating that optional retirement benefits were meant only for employees who suffered an actual employment loss. Our position is that this is crystal clear. It says employment would otherwise be involuntarily terminated. That's the provision that tells you it has to be a termination of employment.
I guess I'm wondering how you reconcile that with the business exceptions, which have a carve out for things like an employee taking employment with a joint venture, or an employee being transferred to a wholly owned subsidiary. It would seem that those employees are continuing to work. And why would there be a need for an exception if involuntarily terminated didn't cover those sorts of employees?
Because in some of these transactions, there's technical terminations of employment. So when you do an asset sale, as an example, the seller is selling assets to a buyer, typically unaffiliated buyer. They terminate their employees, and then the buyer immediately offers them new employment. So there's a technical termination of employment there. And what the plan is saying is, no, we're not going to provide these benefits in that situation. The intention of these benefits is there is severance enhancements to typical retirement benefits. And the committee members all said this was intended to be a severance-like benefit. And severance usually means employment loss where there's some loss of income, at least for a temporary period of time. And that was intended to kind of cushion the blow, if you will, of a sudden employment loss where you're going to have to go find another job and you probably will have some income loss for a period of time.
Here, all the paperwork, HR paperwork, identifies them as terminated. And doesn't the ring fencing sort of de facto mean that they are being employed by a different employer?
No, the ring fencing simply meant we're not going to allow movements amongst the subsidiaries of historical DuPont. But yes, they were lining up business lines in order to spin them off. So you didn't want people transferring to other departments or other businesses because they were intended to go with this particular business line. And so in this case, all of the plaintiffs were specialty products. They were working for that division. Having them move to Corteva isn't helpful because you're trying to take that whole business and spin it out as a separate corporation.
Doesn't that very structure indicate that it's termination with historical DuPont and employment with the entity that has then been spun off?
Well, again, what Judge Bailson found was they were transferred, not terminated, which I think is correct. They were transferred to Specialty Products. They were employed by Specialty Products for a good 4 months before the spinoff. They were spun off and they stayed employed by Specialty Products. There was not an employment loss. Now, it's true that they were now working for an employer who, after the spinoff, chose not to participate in the plan any further. But that's not a termination of employment. They were working for Specialty Products both before and after. Their parent company changed. That's true. But they didn't suffer a termination of employment. They certainly didn't suffer an income loss.
Let's add 5 minutes to both parties' time because I think we also need to discuss the business exceptions here.
Yeah, what I would say is that in this case, well, first of all, you don't even have to get to those if you agree with my first point. But assuming you want to get to the second point, what the plan administrator here said was, look, number one, there's no employment loss. But number two, this looks a lot like these other business exceptions. And I think the committee particularly focused on asset sales and said, that's what this basically is. We exchanged assets and liabilities amongst these business corporations while they were still under the Dow DuPont umbrella. And so they were basically buying and selling each other assets and liabilities. And then we spun it out. That looks an awful lot like an asset sale. It's just that there's not a technical termination of employment because you're not selling to a third party unaffiliated. You're actually selling amongst what were at the time affiliated businesses, and then you spun them out. And so the plan administrator said, we also think that optional retirement's not available here because it looks like one or more of these business reorganization exceptions. And so we're not going to allow optional retirement in this scenario. And I understand that spinoff is not specifically enumerated. There's no question about that. But I don't think it was an abuse of discretion for the plan administrator to say, again, the intent of this provision, this optional retirement, is to provide a severance enhancement. And these people are not losing their jobs. They're not having an income loss. They're just working for a new employer.
The third business exception, where people are transferred to or employed by a wholly owned subsidiary or, you know, other options. Do those people suffer an employment loss or lose jobs?
No, they do not.
Okay. Yet those are, that's a category of people who are accepted, who are accepted, accepted from the pool of involuntarily terminated folks who would otherwise be eligible for optional retirement. So there's a disconnect here. If some people can be involuntarily terminated insofar as they're transferred to a wholly owned subsidiary and keep and remain employed, then doesn't that mean that involuntary termination doesn't mean a loss of job?
I will grant you that each of these exceptions, you'll see they start as of a certain date. So it appears to me what was going on was that as some issue came up, they amended to add another exception. It's not a model of clarity by any stretch of the imagination. But again, all that means is there's an ambiguity in this provision, and the plan administrator should have been given the discretion to resolve that ambiguity. And here, the district court did not give that discretion. The district court decided I have a different construction and I'm going to impose my construction. And that's not what the abuse of discretion review standard is about.
Normally, when we have a list, particularly a very specific list like this one, the omission of another item on the list, we take as a deliberate exclusion, the exclusiveness canon. Why not apply that here?
Because as the Dowling court said, 60% of Dowling, is that when you're applying an abuse of discretion review standard and the plan administrator has been granted that discretion to not only construe the document, but to supply omissions, the natural conclusion is it's left to the plan administrator to decide if this fits one of the exceptions. And so again, the plan administrator should have been given the discretion to interpret this and be allowed to make a determination as to whether or not this benefit was available to this group of employees.
Okay. Jay Roth, any questions?
No questions, thank you.
We'll hear a rebuttal.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Nina Wasso for the plaintiffs' appellees.
Good morning.
Plaintiffs and the members of the two certified classes are not mere bystanders with only a hypothetical interest in this case. They're ERISA plan participants who are harmed by the loss of opportunity to plan for retirement or pressure their employer. The facts that the district court found after a six-day trial are stark. In the 2019 spinoff, DuPont terminated thousands of employees from the plan sponsor. Their own records mark them as terminated, effective May 31st, 2019, while telling them the spinoff meant, quote, very few changes to your benefits. In fact, the spinoff meant that the terminated employees would never be able to elect early retirement benefits. And in a 15-minute meeting, the plan's committee adopted verbatim an outside memo declaring that the spinoff was an unwritten exception to optional retirement. Nobody told any participants about that decision. The summary plan description, which is a statutorily required disclosure under ERISA, said absolutely nothing about the impact of the spinoff on early or optional retirement benefits. This isn't just a confusing communications case. DuPont failed to provide information to which plaintiffs were legally entitled.
Well, you need to get over standing to make that argument on the merits. Where is the concrete injury, be it informational or traditional injury?
Were you finished with your question? I was attempting to address the first prong of the informational injury standing doctrine, which is that the participants were denied information that they were legally entitled to. The next prong, the adverse consequences of that denial, are that the participants were left without the ability to plan for their retirements, secure their retirement futures.
Vague, capacious notion. What is there in the record that demonstrates anything concrete about some detriment to their ability to plan?
Before I turn to the record, may I just read from Kelly versus RealPage, Your Honor's decision. where there was a failure to disclose legally required information. And on the prong about adverse consequences, this court found that the failure to disclose prevented the appellants from obtaining fair and accurate reporting of their credit information, frustrating Congress's goal of empowering consumers to correct inaccurate information in their credit files and preventing them from being harmed by inaccurate or arbitrary information in their credit reports. Here we have a statute that has very clear intent to provide participants with the ability to police their plans, pressure their employers, know what benefits they were and weren't entitled to. And here, people didn't have that. Just if I could read briefly.
In Kelly, in addition to that interest, the plaintiffs were able to show financial sorts of injuries, like having applied for housing that was denied because of the poor credit report. Where is there something in this record that rises to the level of a financial injury or something more concrete than just deprivation of information?
So it doesn't have to be a financial injury. If it did, then there would be no purpose for the informational standing doctrine, because if you have a financial injury, then you have standing under other concepts of standing. The record that has multiple references, sorry, please let me just find my notes on that, So Mr. Cockrell testified that he would have had conversations with leadership and challenged their position and possibly drive to a different conclusion. Again, he said no certainty of that, but he would have had the opportunity. The opportunity to try to police your plan is in the ERISA legislative history as one of the harms that is articulated for a lack of information. You don't have information that you need about what benefits you are and aren't entitled to and what fiduciary's decision making is, then you have no ability to police your plan. And I can read from the legislative history. Experience has also demonstrated a need for a more particularized form of reporting so that the individual participant knows exactly where he stands with respect to the plan, what benefits he may be entitled to, what circumstances may preclude him from obtaining benefits, what procedures he must follow to obtain benefits, and who are the persons to whom management and investment of his plan funds have been entrusted. At the same time, the safeguarding effect of the fiduciary responsibility section will operate efficiently only if fiduciaries are aware that the details of their dealings will be open to inspection and that individual participants and beneficiaries will be armed with enough information to enforce their own rights as well as the obligations owed by the fiduciary to the plan in general. So transparency is a core purpose of ERISA. Mr. Cockrell did go meet with leadership, but it was only after the spinoff, only after he learned that he was never going to be able to elect early retirement. He would have done that before if he had known, if he had ever been told, you're not going to be employed anymore by your current employer, historical DuPont, after the spinoff. You are never going to have the opportunity to elect early retirement, and you are not going to be able to elect optional retirement either, because we've construed the plan in this way that precludes it.
Even in the language you read, Mr. Cockrell is recognizing that it making a difference is merely a possibility. We don't recognize standing based on speculation about what may happen in the future. What here suggests that any of these steps you've identified would make any difference?
Well, there is no certainty that it would have made any difference, but the loss of opportunity has been recognized in the case law as a basis for finding an adverse consequence for lack of information. And I think it's worth noting that during the trial, when plaintiffs were questioned about what they would have done differently, they drew objections from DuPont's counsel that it called for speculation. Well, of course it calls for speculation. There is no way to know with certainty what people would have done differently. But the whole purpose of the informational injury doctrine is to say, if you're denied information that you are entitled to, how could you ever prove what you would have done if you had that information?
My understanding of the questioning was that the speculation objection was with regard to what the leadership would have done within the companies. And like the question, I mean, one could always say, like, you know, to an individual employee, like, how would you have managed your finances differently? Are there any purchases you would have refrained from making? That sort of thing. And that I don't think would be, I mean, perhaps there would have been an objection, but I didn't see any questioning along those lines.
All the questioning that I saw in the record about what would you have done differently was met with immediate calls for speculation objections. And the participants who testified all said, I didn't know that I'd been terminated. I had no opportunity to do anything. So how were they supposed to testify as to what they would have done differently? If the harm has to be financial, or if there has to be proof of what the person would have done, that really unfairly and you know, in a way that is not consistent with, I think, Kelly versus RealPage, or honestly, TransUnion, unfairly narrows the informational injury doctrine. The downstream consequences in this case were the loss of opportunity to try to police the plan, the inability to plan for their own retirements effectively until much after the spinoff, when they learned that they had been deprived of these opportunities to either early or optional retirement. And, you know, Mr. Benson's testimony that he would have found other employment, I'm not, that is testimony that supports that he would have done something, or that he believes he would have done something. Can he prove that he definitely would have done something? Well, it's a counterfactual, because he was denied the information that he was entitled to. So, and yes, it's true that he wouldn't have been able to go work for Corteva, but Cockrell also testified that he would have potentially sought alternate employment. And maybe they could have gone to work for a different employer that would have had better retirement benefits. They were deprived of that opportunity in the immediate lead up to the spinoff. They could not protect their retirement security, and they could not police the plan. They had no opportunity to go talk to leadership and say, this doesn't make sense. This isn't reasonable. You know, this was a very carefully orchestrated spinoff transaction. It was a very big deal. The last thing that DuPont would have wanted was for people to be going to the press, staging a walkout, organizing in any way other than, you know, to just go along with it. And that's why they were given numerous, very reassuring communications saying nothing is changing with your employment, nothing is changing with your benefits. And that wasn't true. So we think there was an informational injury. Even if your honors do not agree that there was an informational injury, there was a breach of trust, or a harm that is directly analogous to a breach of trust. The appellant's position that a breach of trust has to require mismanagement of plan assets or an economic harm is not supported by the case law. A breach of trust can certainly include fiduciary miscommunications. If that weren't true, Cigna versus Amara would be wrongly decided, and a whole line of other cases about fiduciary miscommunications. Worth noting that in Cigna versus Amara, there was similarly no benefits decision for the class members to make. They had been misinformed about what the future of their benefits would be, and that was sufficient to warrant a remedy. And on remand in the Second Circuit, this court noted that by hiding the truth about the plan, Cigna prevented all of its employees from becoming disaffected, spreading knowledge regarding the plan to others who stood to lose more from the benefit conversion and from planning for their retirement. So again, these are the types of losses, harms, that courts have found cognizable in the context of ERISA fiduciary disclosure violations.
What do we do with the Supreme Court's explanation in Thole that beneficiaries of a defined benefit trust can't rely on the common law analogy, that's different in kind, because we've got beneficiaries of private trusts in common law?
Well, Thole is a very specific case having to do with an alleged economic harm that had not come to pass. And there are many pronouncements in other Supreme Court cases, in particular Cigna versus Amara, that the law surrounding rights and obligations under ERISA draws very heavily from the law of trusts. And it's also in the legislative history of ERISA. So I don't know that that comment, that stray comment in Thole, can be expanded in that way. Reasonably, the breach of trust, and this is addressed in the Pender case, is a traditionally recognized claim for any violation of a duty imposed upon a fiduciary. And that ERISA section 404 draws directly from that concept of a breach of trust. I'd like to make sure I address the optional retirement claim before I run out of time. We heard some arguments about termination of employment. I think it's worth noting that there is a plain language meaning behind termination of employment. It means that the person no longer worked for the job in the job that they had. They didn't work for the same employer. And the termination was certainly involuntary because it was not by the employee's choice. And if you look at the committee's interpretation, so-called interpretation, it really doesn't even make any kind of a finding about whether termination was involuntary or not. The crux of the committee's decision-making was around the applicability of the business exceptions. And to build on the questions that Your Honor was asked, Your Honors were asking, the business exceptions are a very specific enumerated list. They do not say that they include other types of transactions that might be analogous to or similar or essentially the same. They're very specific, and a spinoff is not one of them. Dowling's commentary that if you are a fiduciary, a plan fiduciary with discretion, you are enabled to fill gaps in a plan without running afoul of your discretion is not, it's not applicable here because there was no gap. There was a statement that a participant who was involuntarily terminated would be entitled to optional retirement, except in these specific enumerated circumstances.
We are functioning under a standard where we have to give great deference to the plan administrator in the interpretation of the plan. If there is a reasonable interpretation, one of the dictionary definitions of terminated, that is loss of employment, or one could reasonably look at this list and think that an analogy or something very close to the transfer to a subsidiary is what's reflected here. Aren't we obligated to do that?
Respectfully, no, Your Honor. The exercise of discretion here isn't entitled to deference because the interpretation is contrary to the plain language of the plan. The plain language doesn't say something similar to, and indeed plaintiffs don't concede that a spinoff is particularly similar to an asset sale. In an asset sale, the employer that the employee worked for after the sale would still be a participating employer in the plan, whereas that's not true of the spinoff. So, you know, defendants have tried to portray this as just simply a, severance type benefit. There's no evidence for that in the plan. There's no evidence that the committee actually considered that or exercised its discretion in order to make that decision. This court's not obligated to defer to.
We have in the record a meeting that they held, memos that they considered. Why shouldn't we view this as an exercise of discretion?
Well, because the committee's decision was just an adoption of a memo, which was not a fiduciary communication, and because the memo didn't include any evidence, and nor was there any discussion in the meeting of the facts surrounding prior spinoffs or prior asset sales, and they didn't grapple with the plain language of the plan, which is to say This is a specific enumerated list of exceptions, and a spinoff isn't one of them. The exercise of discretion here is not consistent with the plain language of the plan, and that's dispositive. And that's
your understanding of the administrator's power to supply omissions. Like, what type of omissions is the administrator able to supply?
So in Dowling, there was a definition of a term in one section and then silence in another section about the meaning of that term. That's what the court found was a gap that the administrator had discretion to fill. But inserting a whole new term into a plan isn't an appropriate exercise of discretion. The Freitas court said that, other courts have said that. And you know, the discretion to fill gaps or resolve ambiguities doesn't extend to inventing new terms in a plan. And the differences between the spin-off and the enumerated exceptions are significant. And we see no evidence in the record that there was any discussion of that, or that there was any discussion of, in fact, whether this was an involuntary termination of employment. Dowling supports the district court's interpretation. And even if there was ambiguity in the plan, which we contend there wasn't, the inconsistent interpretation that the plan committee made regarding the meaning of involuntary termination versus transfer or separation, that weighs in favor of finding an abuse of discretion. The procedural defects and the bare assertion of past practice being consistent with this interpretation, which is again unsupported. There was a single participant in the Chemours spinoff who applied for optional retirement and was denied not based on the business exceptions. So there is no track record here that the committee was relying on. I see that I'm almost out of time. So if Your Honors—
To what extent are you relying on the notion of procedural irregularity for a structural conflict?
I mean, it's there, but it's not the main part of our argument. The main part of our argument is this is an unambiguous plan. The interpretation that the committee made was contrary to the plain text of the plan. And that even if it was ambiguous, the interpretation was arbitrary and capricious because it's inconsistent with the plain text of the plan, which provides a very specific list of business exceptions and provides for optional retirement in the case of involuntary termination, which is what happened here. The facts about procedural irregularities, the financial conflict of interest, and the lack of meaningful deliberation by the committee are helpful and support the argument for an abuse of discretion or for arbitrary and capricious decision-making, but we're not relying on them centrally. The central allegation is that this was an unambiguous plan and that the district court got that correct.
Do you agree with your friend on the other side of the aisle that were we to disagree with your view as to standing, that the consequence is a clawback of benefits that have been paid out?
Well, no, for the optional retirement class, because they also prevailed on count two. And the remedy for that was the opportunity to elect the benefit, which many people did. For the early retirement class, I mean, there's... If the question is, do I expect that the plan administrator would attempt to claw back that money? I believe that it would. Yes, that's based on representations that counsel have made throughout this litigation.
Are there any legal impediments or qualifications on doing so?
We believe so, and I think we would need to reserve argument about that until such time as it, I mean, there is a whole body of law around when a benefit can be clawed back and whether it would even be possible if people have spent it, whether that money is considered you know, commingled with the participants' general assets. And at that point, it becomes impossible for it to be clawed back through a claim under Section 502A3 of ERISA. That's something we would have to brief. I don't think that there's sufficient argument about that before this court. Did you ask?
I have no Thank questions. You. Thank you.
Let me address some of the last questions you were asking. Procedural irregularity. The courts that have found procedural irregularity were involving situations where like additional steps were added to the normal claim process or something of that where you vary from the normal process for obtaining a benefit. There's no evidence here of that type of irregularity. There really was no procedural irregularity.
Isn't it an unusual procedure to have the committee meeting with a memo of unknown origin and the meeting as brief as it was, simply adopting the terms of the memo?
So I think the context that was given, the testimony that was given was the committee had previously construed that optional retirement provision in the context of a spinoff of Chemours. And the committee had decided the spinoff was a business reorganization exception, as well as a lack of termination of employment. The committee was being asked, are you sticking with that interpretation for the purposes of this upcoming spinoff, or do you intend to change your interpretation? Because you got to remember what was going on at the time was the benefits department was putting out communications about the spinoff. And so they simply asked, are you going to confirm your interpretation, or are you going to change your interpretation? It's not surprising at all that took 15 minutes because they all decided unanimously, we want to stick and be consistent with our prior interpretation.
Well, I don't believe the district court found that they were asked whether they wanted to stick with or change the interpretation. I mean, the district court found that the memo said, please stick with your prior interpretation. And then the committee said, okay.
In context, though, I think, again, what they were being asked to do is tell us, is this your interpretation going forward? Or are you changing it?
But and nonetheless, there was no challenge to the prior interpretation as to whether that was a reasonable interpretation.
There was no challenge to the prior interpretation, correct.
And do you disagree that the one employee who was denied benefits in that prior spinoff was denied for a different reason?
I believe he was denied because he was under the age of 50. And because he was under the age of 50, the plan says you have to have a loss of employment due to lack of work. And so that was explained to him as you did not have a loss of employment. And so therefore you're not entitled to the benefit. But the loss of employment was still consistent. They just didn't get into the business reorganization exceptions in that particular employee's situation. But again, the lack of claims, you have to remember here that the only person who made a claim for optional retirement before the lawsuit was filed was Mr. Cockrell, who was under the age of 50, who's not a member of the optional retirement class. That would suggest to me that the employees understood fully that that benefit's not available in this situation, because if they thought it was, one would think we would have gotten a number of claims, right? If you thought you were entitled to this benefit, then you would make a claim for it. But we did not get those claims. We got one from Mr. Cockrell who asked for it in the alternative to early retirement. And he didn't even ask for early retirement to start. He says, please grandfather me. I want to continue to work for New DuPont, and I want that to count to earning early retirement, which, of course, is not the way the plan works. But that was the only claim. Again, that would suggest strongly is that people understood this was a severance-type benefit, and none of them were severed. Now, let me go to the information about speculation and evidence. You know, what the plaintiffs are neglecting to tell you is that over our objection, they were allowed to call the former CEO of Dow DuPont and testify at trial, and he was then current CEO of New DuPont. They didn't ask him, if Mr. Cockrell had come to you and complained, would you have changed your mind? Would you have called off the spinoffs? Would you have changed the plan? Would you have amended the plan? Would you have done something for them? They could have asked those questions. I think the answer would have been no, but they could have asked those questions if they had wanted to. They also were allowed to depose the former CFO of Dow DuPont, Nicholas Fanakis. They didn't ask those questions of him either. They chose not to go down that path, apparently because they thought they were going to get an answer that was not helpful to them. In terms of lost opportunities, the courts that have found lost opportunity standing, there's a specific opportunity for a financial gain where there's a high likelihood that if they had certain information, they would be entitled to that financial gain. And the ecosystems case that are cited in the party's briefs is that. And ecosystems was actually on a motion to dismiss. So we don't even know if it had gone to trial what the end result would be. But it was a very specific issue with a very specific financial gain at stake, with a very specific right that was being deprived. That is miles away from this case. I see I'm out of my 5 minutes. Thank you.
All right, we understand the arguments. We thank both counsel for their briefing and argument this morning, and we'll take the case under advisement.